does not fulfill prophecy, and so the exact specific title of our first session is on the modern state of Israel and Bible prophecy. And then in our second session, we'll go more into the future prophecy concerning the final restoration of Israel and distinguish that from the present one we're going to be dealing with in this session. Before I get into my topic, I want to share a little thing I read recently. We run a Messianic camp in upstate New York for the training of Jewish believers, and I'll say a bit more about that program a bit later. But we just recently, this summer, completed our new lecture hall, and while God provided the money and the staff to build it, the government was a bit slow in issuing the permits. They kept delaying it for one reason of paper, for one legal technicality after another. Although it finally came, we're able to finish the building the day before we had to use it. And I read this article that brought home anybody involved in building, including Wayside Chapel, must have run into something like this in the course of its expansion program, written by an anonymous writer who works for the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency. And I'll quote what he wrote. God created the heavens and the earth, and quickly he was faced with a class action suit for failure to file an environmental impact statement. He was granted a temporary permit for the heavenly part of the project, but he was stymied with a cease and desist order for the earthly part. Appearing at the hearing, God was asked why he began his earthly project in the first place. He replied he just liked to be creative. Then God said, let there be light. Immediately, the officials demanded to know how the light would be made. Would there be strip mining? What about thermal pollution? God explained the light would come from a huge ball of fire, and God was granted permission to make light, assuming that no smoke would result from the ball of fire. And to conserve energy, the light would have to be out half the time. God agreed and said he would call the light day and the darkness night. The officials replied they were not interested in semantics. God said, let the earth bring forth green herb and such they may see. The Environmental Protection Agency agreed as long as only native seed was used. Then God said, let the waters bring forth the creeping creatures having life and the fowl that they may fly over the earth. The officials pointed out that this would require the approval of the Game and Fish Commission, coordinated with the Heavenly Wildlife Federation and the Audubon Gelic Society. Everything was okay until God said he wanted to complete the project in just 6 days. Officials said it would take at least 100 days to review the application and the impact statement. After that, there would have to be a public hearing. Then there would be at least 10 to 12 months before the first permit could be issued. And at this point, God created hell. Now, in our topic for our first session, entitled The Modern State of Israel and Bible Prophecy, you'll hear four voices out there giving four different perspectives. I'll discuss the first three of these in the introduction. I'll mention the fourth one a bit later, and then I'll be dealing with a fifth one. But the first voice is the voice of replacement theology that sees the modern Jewish state as purely an accident of history, totally unrelated to any type of Bible prophecy. This first voice believes that when Israel rejected the Messiahship of Jesus, God was forever through with the Jewish people. And therefore, there is no unfulfilled prophecies for the Jewish people, and there is no restoration. Rather, when Israel rejected the Messiah, all of God's covenantal promises were transferred to the church. Hence, we have a theology of transference. Or put a bit differently, when Israel rejected the Messiah, the church replaced Israel in God's standing, and therefore a theology of replacement. Now, Jews could be saved today, but they'll simply be amalgamated into a larger church, but God has no future restoration for Israel as an ethnic people. And so nothing happening with Israel in any way is related to prophecy. There is no future prophecy for Israel either. And so again, the modern Jewish state is nothing but an accident of history. Then comes the second voice. The second voice takes the opposite view in that they do believe there will be a final restoration of Israel. And they do take these various prophecies quite literally. At the first voice, when you look at these prophecies, agree these prophecies are there, but they go on to say that these prophecies must not be understood literally, but allegorically and spiritually. And so the regathering of the Jews these prophecies speak about really mean a regathering of the elect into a church until the church is complete. But the second voice takes these prophecies literally and believes that there will be a future final restoration of the Jewish people, all of the promised land. However, when they look at the modern Jewish state, they have a hard time fitting the modern Jewish state into Bible prophecy, because these prophecies they look at talk about a final regathering in faith in preparation for blessing. They view Israel as a believing nation in the Messiah. And when they look at the present Jewish state, the majority are unbelievers in the Messiah. In fact, of the 5.1 million Jews in the land today, only about 4,000 to 5,000 maximum are Jewish believers in the land today. And to make it worse, the vast majority of Israelis not even Orthodox. They would class themselves quite secularly, either as atheist or agnostic. And that just doesn't seem to fit these prophecies they look at. And so they would agree with the first voice that a modern Jewish state is an accident of history. It's not relevant to Bible prophecy at all. But they disagree with the first voice and that they do believe there will be such a future final restoration. But again, the modern Jewish state has nothing to do with Bible prophecy. And the verses they are looking at, we'll look at in our second session. Then we have a third voice, and the third voice says that what we are seeing today is the final restoration of Israel. This is the beginnings of the fulfillment of all those prophecies. And there'll be more and more Jews going back to the land until all are back into land. At some point, they'll undergo a national regeneration and salvation, and then the Messiah will return. When you ask about those prophecies that speak of a period of divine wrath and tribulation preceding this time, they would say that the tribulation prophecies have already been fulfilled in the Holocaust. And the Nazi Holocaust fulfilled all the prophecies about the tribulation, and so there is no future tribulation to come. It has already passed. And what we're seeing today is the final restoration. And emissaries of this third voice are traveling throughout the world, encouraging Jews to return, and especially go among groups of Jewish believers and Messianic fellowships and Messianic congregations, laying guilt trips on Jewish believers. If they don't go back to Israel right away, they are living in sin, because God is now calling all Jews, particularly Jewish believers in the Messiah, back to their land. To live outside the land here in the flesh parts of San Antonio would be living in sin. And yes, in for biblical passages to prove it, they refer to those prophecies where the prophets called the Jews to leave Babylon. And they interpret these passages on Babylon not to be Babylon, past or future, but Babylon represents the United States of America. When you point out that these prophecies mention the Euphrates River, which is in Babylonia, they say that river is not really the Euphrates, it's the Hudson River in New York City. And I was surprised, prophets like Jeremiah, among others. And so with the third voice, this is the final restoration. This is the fulfillment of those prophecies, at least initial stages. Now again, as the fourth voice, we'll come back to a little bit later. But all of these voices forget, particularly the first three voices forget or don't observe, is that when the Bible speaks of a worldwide regathering of the Jewish people, speaks of actually two worldwide regatherings. First of all, there's to be a worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment, specifically the judgment of the tribulation. And that's to be followed by another worldwide regathering, a regathering in faith in preparation for blessing, the blessing of the Messianic kingdom. So again, as we'll see, there are two worldwide regatherings. First, a regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment, followed by another worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessing. Now, the prophecies that speak of the worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessing will be the topic for our second session. In this session, we want to focus on those prophecies that clearly spoke of worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment. In so doing, we're going to look at three key passages, and then we'll look at a fourth corollary passage, and then we'll look at some two other areas that are relevant to our basic theme for the first session, the modern Jewish state in Bible prophecy. We begin then looking at three key passages. So if you will take your Bibles, let's begin by turning to Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel chapter 20. Ezekiel chapter 20. We'll begin reading with verse 33, Ezekiel chapter 20 and verse 33. As I live, says the Lord Jehovah, surely with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, with wrath poured out, will I be king over you. Now I'll bring you out from the peoples, and I will gather you out of the countries wherein you are scattered, with a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, and with wrath poured out. I'll bring you into the wilderness of the peoples, and there will I enter into judgment with you face to face. Like as I entered into judgment with your fathers in the wilderness land of Egypt, so will I enter into judgment with you, says the Lord Jehovah. Now I'll cause you to pass under the rod, and I'll bring you the bond of the covenant. Now I'll purge out from among you the rebels and them that transgress against me. I will bring them forth out of the land where they sojourn, but they shall not enter into the land of Israel, and you shall know that I am Jehovah. In these verses, Ezekiel draws a simile with the Exodus. At the Exodus, under Moses, God brought the entire nation of Israel out of the land of Egypt and brought them into the wilderness of the Sinai Peninsula. And God's plan and program for Israel and the Sinai was to accomplish two things. First of all, they were to receive the law of Moses, and secondly, they were to build a tabernacle through which much of the law could then be maintained. And then with these two things accomplished, they were to press on and to entomb the promised land itself. But because of a series of rebellings and murmurings against God's revealed will, finally at the oasis of Kadesh Barnea, which was right on the border of the promised land, for once you walk past Kadesh, you're in the promised land, God entered into judgment with his people. And the divine judgment of Numbers 13 and 14 was that those who came out of Egypt would now have to continue wandering throughout the wilderness until 40 years is over with. And during those 40 years, all who came out will die out, except for two righteous spies and those below the age of 20. So that 40 years later was a new nation, a nation that was born as freemen in the wilderness, not the slaves in Egypt, they'll be allowed to enter the land under Joshua. And that historical frame of reference is something of a backdrop for the future, but this time Ezekiel prophesies God will regather his people from all parts of the world. And we should notice that in verse 33 and 34 and 35, it is a gathering out of wrath and a gathering for wrath. A gathering out of wrath and a gathering for wrath. They were gathered out of the wrath of the Holocaust, and the events of the Nazi Holocaust, where 6 million Jewish people died, created the world stage for Israel to become a state. It created the world stage for the regathering of unbelief. But because it's a regathering in unbelief, it's a regathering for a future time of wrath. In the future time of wrath, God will once again enter into judgment with his people, and he points out the rebels among them. In verse 37 and 38, will be purged out. And those who are remain are going to turn to the Lord. They'll be brought into the bond of the covenant, specifically the bond of the new covenant. They'll be brought into national salvation. And so that is going to be a new nation, a regenerate nation, that will be allowed to enter the land under King Messiah for the final restoration. But in these verses, Ezekiel clearly describes a worldwide regathering in unbelief from wrath and for wrath in preparation for a specific period of judgment that will then lead to a national salvation, that will then lead to their final restoration. The second passage is over in Ezekiel chapter 22. Here again you'll see a regathering in unbelief, but the focus is slightly different. The focus in chapter 20 was on the land in general, but the focus here in chapter 22 is going to be specifically on the city or in the city of Jerusalem. We're in chapter 22 of Ezekiel, verse 17. Verse 17, the word of Jehovah came unto me, saying, Son of man, the house of Israel has become dross unto me. All of them are brass and tin and iron and lead in the midst of the furnace. They are the dross of silver. Therefore, thus says the Lord Jehovah, because you all become dross, therefore, behold, I will gather you into the midst of Jerusalem, as they gather silver and brass and iron and lead and tin in the midst of the furnace, to blow the fire upon it and to melt it. So will I gather you in my anger and in my wrath, and I will lay you there and melt you. Yea, I will gather you and blow upon you with the fires of my wrath, and you shall be melted in the midst thereof. As silver is melted in the midst of the furnace, so shall ye be melted in the midst thereof, and ye shall know I, Jehovah, have poured out my wrath upon you. Notice again, he's regathering them, this time focusing upon the city of Jerusalem. And furthermore, it's also regathering in unbelief because they are filled with the impurities of dross and tin and iron and lead. It also regathered for a future time of wrath when the wrath of God will be poured upon them for the purpose of melting them and to purify them. So as a purified believing nation, they will then turn to the Lord. But here again, he speaks of worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for specific future judgment, but the purpose of the judgment is to bring them to national repentance. Only then will they have the final worldwide restoration in faith. Now the third passage is the minor prophet Zephaniah. The minor prophet Zephaniah. It will be in Zephaniah chapter 2. Now Zephaniah chapter 1 verses 7 through 18. Zephaniah 1 verses 7 through 18. The prophet is describing a period of time that he calls the day of Jehovah or the day of the Lord. And this is the most common biblical term for the tribulation. Most common term today is tribulation, great tribulation, but the most common biblical term in both testaments is the day of Jehovah or the day of the Lord. It describes this as a terrible period of time that Israel and the world will have to go through. When we get to chapter 2, however, he discusses an event that must come before that period of the day of the Lord. And notice how often the word before is going to be used. So begin with Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 1. Zephaniah 2, verse 1. Gather yourselves together, yea, gather together, O nation that hath no shame, before the decree brings forth, before the day passes the chaff, before the fierce anger of Jehovah come upon you, before the day of Jehovah's anger come upon you. Four times he says before, and before the period of wrath of chapter 1 comes, before the day of Jehovah comes, he points out there must be a gathering of the nation. But it's a gathering in unbelief, a nation that is not yet ashamed of its sin, and therefore the purpose of this period is to bring that shame to cause her to turn to her true God. And so this prophecy clearly specifies this will have to become a state sometime before the tribulation itself could start. So we have three clear passages that clearly speak of a worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment, specifically the judgment of the tribulation. There's a fourth passage which would be corollary to the first three. It's found in Isaiah chapter 11. Isaiah chapter 11. Now at this point, let me mention the fourth voice I didn't mention earlier. And the fourth voice recognizes that there are two types of regathering prophecies. And they recognize that there is a regathering in unbelief and a regathering in faith. But then the fourth voice goes on to say, we really cannot be sure that the present Jewish state, as we see it today, is a fulfillment of those prophecies that spoke of the regathering in unbelief. And why not? Because they believe that you can have regathering with unbelief followed by dispersion, another regathering with unbelief followed by another dispersion, you can have several regatherings with unbelief before you have the specific one that fulfills those prophecies we just looked at. So again, the fourth voice recognizes there are two types of regatherings, but is not sure whether the modern Jewish state actually fits. But the passage in Isaiah will tell us that's exactly what cannot be. You cannot have several regatherings in unbelief from the four corners of the earth. Now the entire context begins in Isaiah chapter 11, verse 11, and goes to the end of chapter 12. That's the context. 11:11 through chapter 12, verse 6. And in this context, he is speaking of the worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessing. He is speaking of the final one. So how is that relevant to our topic at the moment? It's relevant because when he discusses that final worldwide regathering, he numbers it in a specific way. And let's look at it in chapter 11 and verse 11. It shall come to pass in that day the Lord will set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people that shall remain from Assyria and from Egypt and from Pathros and from Cush and from Elam and from Shinar and from Hamat and from the islands of the sea. He will set up an ensign for nations and will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. And he discusses the final worldwide regathering in preparation for the Messianic Kingdom. In verse 11, he labels it as the second one. In other words, the last one is only the second one. If the last one is the second one, how many more can you have before that? Only one. Even with the new math, only one. So in other words, the Bible does not allow for several worldwide regatherings in unbelief, only allows for one worldwide regathering in unbelief, followed by this last one, which is the second one. And this text permits only two worldwide regatherings from the four corners of the earth. And therefore, the present Jewish state is very relevant to Bible prophecy. Now, in addition to these passages that speak of a worldwide regathering unbelief in preparation for judgment, the theme for the first session is the modern Jewish state and Bible prophecy. Let me now talk about three other things, which are other areas that are relevant to that particular theme. I'll talk about three other things. Number one, the start of the tribulation. Number two, the third temple. And number three, the invasion of Ezekiel 38 and 39. I will take them individually. First of all, let's talk about how the tribulation actually starts. Let's begin with the book of Daniel, chapter 9. Daniel, chapter 9. Now beginning in verse 24 of Daniel chapter 9, going down to verse 27, Daniel the prophet is being given his famous vision of the 77s, or the 490-year period that God has decreed over the Jewish people. It goes beyond our purpose in the evening study to deal with the passage phrase by phrase. If you do this on your own, what you discover is this. When you come to the end of verse 26, the first 483 years of this 490-year period has already been fulfilled in history, coming to an end at the time of the first coming of the Messiah. But we still have 7 years left to run of this prophetic time clock over Israel, the same 7 years as that of the tribulation. And the question we have to ask now is this. What will be the one singular event that will begin the 7 years of tribulation, the 70th seven of Daniel, taking away? And that's what brings us to verse 27 of Daniel chapter 9 that says, "And he shall make a firm covenant with many for 1 7." Now the pronoun he goes back to its narrowest antecedent, which is found in verse 26, as the prince that shall come. In other words, the prince that shall come in verse 26, and he who makes a covenant in verse 27, is the one, the same individual, better known in most Christian circles today as simply the Antichrist. And so the last 7 years begin with one specific decisive event, the signing of a seven-year treaty between Israel and the Antichrist. That is the event that starts the tribulation. It will not be the rapture as such that will begin the tribulation. Those of you that know me know I'm very strongly pre-tribulational. I certainly believe that the church will be raptured before the tribulation starts. I'm both pre-trib, pre-mill, and pre-everything. I say I won't even eat post toasties for breakfast to avoid any appearance of false teaching. But the rapture is an imminent event that could happen any time. It's not determined by any set of events. People talk about signs of the rapture. The rapture is a signless event, and therefore will never be a datable event in spite of the people making money writing books that they know when the rapture will occur. The rapture will come before the tribulation, but it might come 10, 20, 30, 40 years before the tribulation. We simply don't know. But the starting point of the tribulation is never set to be the rapture, but the signing of this seven-year covenant. Until this covenant is signed, the tribulation cannot begin. But if that's true, then that presupposes two other things in place. One is not, but one is. First of all, this presupposes that the Antichrist is already in high political power before the tribulation, with whom a sovereign state like Israel could sign a covenant of this nature, because sovereign states like Israel do not sign covenants with nobodies. And that has not yet taken place. So the Antichrist to high political power has not yet come. But the second thing this presupposes is that there is a Jewish state with a Jewish government with whom a covenant like this could be signed. That has only been true as of 1948. Biblically speaking, the rapture could have come before 1948, but the tribulation could not have come before 1948. There was no Jewish state, no Jewish government with whom a covenant like this could be signed. And this one thing is in place. In other words, this passage required a Jewish state in existence before the tribulation, and we now have one. But again, the rapture does not depend upon any of these things. And keep in mind, the blessed hope for the church is not looking for the rise of the Antichrist. He's no blessing. The blessed hope for the church is the return of the Lord to the earth to take us to where he left for. It's not the rise of the Antichrist. Now, a question has risen. Has the modern signing of a treaty with Yasser Arafat, the PLO, fulfilled this prophecy? In fact, there is one person going around this particular state, especially teaching that theology, that the tribulation began when Yasser Arafat and Israel signed this covenant at the White House. Another passage that deals with the same covenant in Isaiah 28, verses 14 through 22, tells us the reason Israel even bothers to make a covenant like this is for reasons of military security. That when they sign this covenant, they're trusting the Antichrist for the military security. Believe me, nobody in Israel is trusting Yasser Arafat for their military security. Not a soul. So what happened with the PLO is certainly significant historically and politically, but has nothing to do with this particular prophecy. This is yet future. But it does require the existence of a Jewish state before the tribulation, and we have it. The second element concerning the modern Jewish state has to do with the third temple. I want to read four passages of scripture, and only have to read all four will I make my comments on them. The first one is again here in Daniel 9 and verse 27. He shall make a firm covenant with many for 1 7, the middle of 7, he will cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And upon the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, and even to the full end, and that determined, shall wrath be put out upon the desolate. Second passage is Matthew 24. The Gospel of Matthew chapter 24. and verse 15. That's Matthew 24 and verse 15. When therefore you see the abomination of desolation which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let them that reads understand, then let them through Judea flee unto the mountains. Third passage is 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Second Thessalonians chapter 2 with verse 3 and 4. Second Thess 2, verse 3. Let no man beguile you any wise, but will not be except the falling away come first, the man of sin be revealed, the sin of perdition. He that opposes and exalts himself against all that is called God or that is worshipped, so that he sits in the temple of God, setting himself forth as God. And the fourth passage is Revelation 11. Revelation chapter 11, verse 1. Revelation chapter 11, verse 1. There was given me a reed like unto a rod, that once said, Rise and measure the temple of God and the altar and them that worship therein. And the court which is without the temple, leave without and measure it not. Having given unto the Gentiles, in the holy city will they tread underfoot 42 months. No four passages speak of an event that will happen in the middle of the 7 years of tribulation, an event that the Bible calls the abomination of desolation. The abomination of desolation is when the Antichrist will break the 7-year covenant with Israel. He'll break it after 3.5 years. He will then take over the Jewish temple, seat himself in it, and proclaim himself to be God Almighty, and call upon the whole world to worship him as God, and to signify their acceptance of his deity by taking his mark of 666. Now again, that event takes place in the middle of the tribulation, so how is that relevant to our present theme of the modern Jewish state in Bible prophecy? It's relevant in that it means that the Jewish people are in control of the temple compound. Now, the fact that these events take place in the middle of the tribulation means that by the middle of the tribulation, the temple is both standing and functioning, which means we're left with two options as to when the temple might be rebuilt. The temple might be rebuilt during the first 2.5 years of the tribulation, or it might be rebuilt even before the tribulation starts. We cannot make it more exact than that. Only thing we know for sure is that by the midpoint, it is standing and functioning for a while. Well, that presupposes Jewish control of the temple compound area. Israel became a state in 1948, but the city of Jerusalem was divided in two for 19 years, from 48 to 67. The eastern part of Jerusalem, which was the biblical Jerusalem, the old city, which had a temple compound, was in Jordanian and not Jewish hands. In 1967, 19 years after Israel became a state, broke out the Six-Day War, and one of the byproducts of the Six-Day War was the takeover of the temple compound area. In other words, it was impossible to have the temple rebuilt before 1967, only became a possibility since 1967. The Bible required eventual Jewish control of the temple compound, and that did happen in the year 1967. Now, in spite of many rumors you might hear, there is no actual active building of the temple going on. And now and then these rumors break out. None of them are true. But there are two things that are corollary to the temple we might notice. First of all, there is one group in the Jewish quarter of the old city that is making furnishings for the next temple. They've already made a number of items, such as the various tools and shovels to carry out the ashes from the altar. They've made the various jars for the water oblations, wine oblations, and the pouring of the blood. They've made the scarlet thread for the scapegoat. They've made the lots for the scapegoat, and so on. They haven't yet made the high priestly garments, but they've begun making the common priestly garments. They want to have all these things ready so when the third temple is built, they can put these things right in. A sudden that's happening is another group called the Ateret HaKohanim, located in the Muslim quarter of the Old City. They are training priests to do sacrifices. What they have on their computer is people named of Cohen, which means they are descendants of Aaron, who are also Orthodox as far as their Judaism is concerned. And they're training these Orthodox Cohens in doing proper sacrifices. So they'll have Levitical priests trained to do these things once the temple is rebuilt. So those two things are happening, but the temple itself is not yet being built as such. In light of that, let me answer a couple of questions that come up in connection with the temple and many of the conferences I have. First of all, the issue of the Ark of the Covenant. And if you read some of the more popular books in recent times, there are several groups out there looking for the Ark of the Covenant. They all seem to know where it is, but they can't find it anyway. And the assumption is that they need to have the Ark of the Covenant before the temple could be rebuilt, and so they're trying to help God out to get his prophecies fulfilled as if God needs anybody's help. But the fact is, first of all, that the Ark is not essential for the temple to be rebuilt, because when the Jews came back from Babylonian captivity and rebuilt the second temple, they had no Ark of the Covenant. And the second temple stood for 6 centuries, from 515 BC until AD 70. And for 6 centuries, they brought in the blood to the Holy of Holies, but they sprinkled it without the Ark of the Covenant. And the temple standing in Jesus' day had no Ark of the Covenant. So you don't need to have the Ark for the temple to be rebuilt. And furthermore, I doubt very much that the Ark of the Covenant still exists. It was probably destroyed with the Babylonian destruction, because the Bible lists all the things that Nebuchadnezzar took with him to Babylon, and the text says the rest was destroyed by fire, which would include the Ark of the Covenant. And keep in mind, the Ark was merely a box of wood overlaid with gold, so all he would need to do is strip the gold, and then he would burn the box. And so that's why even 70 years later, when they came back, there was no Ark of the Covenant to put into the Holy of Holies anymore. They couldn't find it after 70 years. I doubt they can find it after 2,500 years. So there's a lot of energy being spent, I think, for naught. The second issue that's come up with the Jewish temple has to do with the ashes of the red heifer. One particular teacher has been traveling around the country saying he knows what the ashes of the red heifer are, so give me money and he'll find it for you. It goes on to say they have to have the ashes of the previous red heifer to mix with new ones before the temple could be dedicated. Again, not true. If you look at the laws of the red heifer ashes in Numbers 19, there's nothing about mixing it with previous red heifer ashes. There's no need to find the old ones. If you find a bunch of ashes, how can you tell where they came from? And by Jewish law, when they finally are ready for the temple to function, they will simply slaughter a red heifer, burn it, and bingo, they have new ashes. They don't need the old ones. The third issue that's come up only in the last couple of months because of riots has to do with this Hasmonean tunnel that has been in the news that caused the recent riots in Israel and the outbreak of conflict. Some of the news reports may imply they have recently opened this tunnel. No, it's not. It has been open now for about 10 years. And people have been going through it, and I went through it 2 years ago, and I brought my last study group through it just last June. What they opened was merely a new exit, not the tunnel itself. Up until that point, you would have to go out the same way you came in from the Jewish quarter. But the tunnel walk is quite narrow, and to expedite tourism, they simply opened up a new exit in the Muslim quarter, which created the riot, because Israel doing anything in the Muslim quarter means they're exercising authority, which the Arabs do not recognize. Nor is the tunnel underneath the temple. It's actually paralleling the whole western wall just outside the temple. It doesn't actually put you underneath the temple. It doesn't lead you to any secret cave where the ark might be. And I've been asked, has this got to do anything with Bible prophecy? Again, the answer is no. And of course, in the past, when I was a member of this church for 9 years, we must avoid this sensational type of approach to prophecy and use newspaper exegesis and then interpret the Bible by the daily press. Let me again emphasize the fact that Bible prophecy is never fulfilled approximately. It's always fulfilled exactly and precisely. Until the Bible, until you have a prophecy totally fulfilled, you don't have any fulfillment. But furthermore, it must be a clear prophecy, and there's nothing in the prophecies concerning this particular tunnel. It's merely an archaeological excavation exposing the entire western compound wall of the temple compound. But the only thing really relevant in Bible prophecy for now is, number one, Israel's control of the temple compound. Secondly, the building of the furnishings for the temple. And thirdly, the training of priesthoods for the temple. Everything else at this point is too premature to see something significant prophetically. Now, the third corollary thing I want to talk about has to do with the invasion of Ezekiel 38 and 39. Let's turn to it. Now, Ezekiel 38 and 39 describe an invasion of a confederation of nations from the north, as well as located in the south, that invades Israel. It goes beyond our purpose right now to deal with the identification of these invaders or to expand this passage. I only want to deal with certain issues found in the passage that are directly relevant to the modern Jewish state today. And the first thing I want to point out two key things. First of all, what kind of Israel is described in this passage at the time of this invasion? What kind of Israel are they describing? Look at chapter 38, verse 8. After many days you shall be visited, latter years you shall come back into land that is brought back from the sword, that is gathered out of many peoples upon the mountains of Israel, which have been a continual waste, but is now brought forth out of the peoples, and they shall dwell securely, all of them. Skip down to verse 12. To take the prey and to spoil, to take the prey, to turn your hand against the waste places that now inhabit it, against the people that are gathered out of the nations, that have gotten cattle and goods, and that dwell in the middle of the earth. The kind of Israel describes in verse 8 and verse 12 is an Israel that has been regathered from the nations around the world. A nation that is rebuilding wasted cities that have been laying desolate for many centuries. A nation that's regathered after being pursued by the sword, by gathering out of wrath. And contextually, regathered unbelief because they begin to believe only after this invasion at the end of chapter 39. In other words, he's not describing an Israel that was true of Israel in ancient history. This was describing his Israel has only been like this since 1948. And the main point to note as far as our present theme is that this invasion could not have come before 1948. Before that, didn't have an Israel described in that's described this way in these verses. The second thing to note in this passage is exactly where in the land are the invading armies destroyed. They do succeed in penetrating the country. Only then God moves to destroy them by his divine power. But where in the land will they be destroyed? Skip over to chapter 39 and verse 2. 39 verse 2, and I will turn you about and will lead you on and will cause you to come up from the uttermost parts of the north. Now bring you upon the mountains of Israel. Verse 4, you shall fall upon the mountains of Israel, you and all your hordes, etc. Now when the prophet talks about the mountains of Israel, he refers to the central mountain range, which makes up the basic backbone of the country. In the Old Testament, these were known as the hill country of Ephraim and the hill country of Judah. In New Testament times, as Samaria and Judea. Within these mountains, you have your famous biblical cities like Dothan, Shechem, Samaria, Ramah, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Bethel and Ai, Hebron. And so these armies do enter the central mountain ranges of Israel. The obvious target is the city of Jerusalem located in these mountains. However, from 1948 until 1967, these mountains, for the most part, were not in Israel. They were in Jordan. These mountains now refer to politically as the West Bank.
And Jordanian forces took over these mountains in 1948, and next to them as being part of the Jordan. All Israel had was a small corridor, known as the Jerusalem Corridor, and the border of Israel and Jordan ran down the foot of these mountains, cut into the hill country, cut Jerusalem in two, and came out again. Israel had maybe 5% or less of the mountains. For the most part, the mountains of Israel were not in Israel, they were in Jordan. But another byproduct of the Six-Day War, besides the temple compound falling into Jewish control, that's when these mountains fell into Jewish control. Not only could this prophecy not be fulfilled before 1948, it could not be fulfilled before 1967 either. Only at that point did these mountains fall under Israeli sovereignty. This again raises the question that I won't answer in this session, I'll answer next session. What about the recent withdrawals of the previous Israeli government and the contemplation of the present government withdrawn from Hebron and perhaps some other places? We'll discuss how that fits or does not fit in prophecy in the second hour. It will be more relevant in that second session. But the point is that these mountains, what is now called the West Bank, is yet have a very important, relevant role in Bible prophecy. But for the present state, they became part of Israel in 1967. So what we've done in this first hour is to point out the Bible speaks of two worldwide regatherings. And we would agree that the present Jewish state is in no way a fulfillment of those prophecies that spoke of worldwide regathering in faith in preparation for blessing, but is a fulfillment of those prophecies that spoke of worldwide regathering in unbelief in preparation for judgment. And besides that, we have these other corollary things happening which are relevant to the modern Jewish state in Bible prophecy. So on the issue of Israel modern prophecy or Bible prophecy, we must keep our balance. On one hand, we must not see more fulfillment than there is. There's a tendency to see a lot more fulfillment than there really is. So again, be careful that we don't see more fulfillment than there is. On the other hand, we must not fail to see the fulfillment that is there. And there is prophetic significance to the present Jewish state. Now again, we'll pick up the second theme in our second session. As you came, you received a blue folder like this. Will you please take yours out and open up all the way? Anyone here not have one of these, raise your hand. We'll get one to you. All right, the ushers can get those from the back foyer. Just keep your hand up. We'll get them to you shortly. When you get your copy, open up all the way. Look at the side that has the picture on it with the words Roots and Reasons in blue. Before we have our break, and before I have offering and break, I want to just say a few things about this ministry. For many of you that know about it, give you some updates of recent years, and for those of you that are new, give you more about us, you know better what we represent as a ministry. Now the word Ariel is a Hebrew word which means the Lion of God. It's an alternate name for Jerusalem, places like Isaiah 29. But that tells you basically what we are. We are Jews who believe in the Messiahship of Jesus, the one the Bible calls the Lion of the tribe of Judah. On December the 1st coming up, we will be 19 years old. Our first 7 years were based here in San Antonio, and then the last 12 years in Orange County, California. But we began here in San Antonio. We're founded on two principles, which are evangelism and discipleship. And by evangelism, our purpose is to get the gospel out to Jewish people in Jewish populated areas. And to do that, we have established branches in different Jewish populated cities. We now have 8 branches here in the USA alone, located in Seattle, Portland, Los Angeles, San Diego on the West Coast, on the East Coast. We have it located in Pennsylvania, Baltimore. Our most newest branch is in Brooklyn, New York, which has a special meaning for me because I became a believer in Brooklyn, New York years ago. And now we have a branch located in Brooklyn, New York. God saved me in Brooklyn and then proceeded to save me out of Brooklyn. We now do have a branch there as well. We also have a branch of all places in Athens, Georgia, to the Jewish students of the University of Georgia. But some of these were part of our goals from the very beginning, but some of these were never part of original goals, but God opened the door and provided the funds and staff, and so we opened them up. The whole idea of having a branch in Georgia was not something we anticipated. We have to make regional adjustments and cultural adjustments, and so in Georgia we have pasta, we have to serve matzo balls and grits to make it fit. And God has used our staff. They operate either as fellowships or they plant full-scale messianic congregations with their own elders and deacons. And being a Jewish congregation, they have their own style of worship and things of that nature. And as director, now co-director of the ministry for almost 19 years, every 3 months we receive the core reports on missionary staff. I'm very happy to say that even almost after 19 years, we've never yet had a dry quarter. But that, I mean, we never had a three-month period go by without seeing at least one Jewish person come to saving faith. In most cases, it's been a lot more than one, but never less than one. And God has used our staff quite effectively. Besides our frontline evangelism that goes on these branches, we also evangelize through the printed word. We now publish literature in a variety of languages that are evangelistically oriented. Besides English, we publish in Hebrew, Russian, French, and German. Because we also have a branch in Montreal, Quebec, as of the 1st of this year, which is French-speaking. Incidentally, we also have two branches in East Europe, in Kiev in the Ukraine, St. Petersburg, Russia. We have co-planted two congregations in Israel. And all of these people have been coming to the Lord. One of the books you see at the back table in the foyer is called Jesus Was a Jew. This was a book written for the Jewish Inquirer. We have in our office a very thick file of letters telling from Jewish people that foremost they became believers through that one book. So through our frontline work in the missionary sector and through our printed word, Jewish people are coming to saving faith. Our second principle is called discipleship, a term that's become a bit too loosely used in the churches today. In too many churches, it refers to merely teaching new believer the principles of the spiritual life and how to share his or her faith. We always begin with these because this is the fundamental, foundational lesson they must all learn. But if we stop there, we have not fulfilled true biblical discipleship, which involves intensive Bible teaching, all areas. In Paul's words, the whole counsel of God. This we endeavor to do, but being what we are, we teach the Bible from a strong Jewish perspective. Each of our branches sets up their own discipleship program. We also have an international discipleship program at our New York camp that I mentioned earlier called Camp Shoshana. And for 23 years now, we've had a three-week summer program of intensive Bible teaching. We spend 5 hours a day, Monday through Friday, teaching the Word from its Jewish perspective. About 5-6 years ago, we had a Russian camp that follows it for Russian Jews who don't speak English. This year, we had about 100 Russian Jews attend, half believers, half unbelievers. About 15 became believers, and quite a few were baptized at our lake at the camp. Starting next year, we'll also inaugurate the French-speaking camp for the French Jewish believers of Quebec. Besides our frontline discipleship and the branches and the camp program, we also have many tools by way of books, tapes, both audio and video, manuscripts that you can pursue many areas of biblical studies from the same Jewish perspective. Let's know in a moment how you can get a hold of a catalog and pursue some of these studies. We also have inaugurated a correspondence course, and it's going to be actually 10 parts. The first 4 parts are now ready. I do have a flyer of the correspondence course with me in several of my cases. If you're interested, you can see me during the break at the end of the second session. And the if you take all 10 segments, by the time you're done, you have a comprehensive knowledge of the whole Bible from the same Jewish perspective. And for the average person who has to work 40 hours a week, it'll take about 2 years to complete. But if you have more time, you can finish faster. Less time, you can take longer. The time you take is at your own chosen speed anyway. And so that's available to a larger public. Now, I hope you take the time to read the brochure more thoroughly. You will notice in the course of these years we've become rather multifaceted ministry, but always remember the two principles were based upon evangelizing Jewish people and discipling both Jewish and Gentile believers. Now, in the folder you will see a page with two blue lines across it. If you will, focus your attention upon this page. This outlines 4 ways by which you can participate with us. It starts out by saying, I do indeed commit myself before the Lord to number one, praying for the salvation of the Jewish people. I think the reason we have been successful through our staff of winning Jewish people to the Lord is because everywhere people are praying specifically for Jewish people and doing so by name. San Antonio does have a Jewish population. If you know Jewish people, either as friends or neighbors, schoolmates or workmates, I'd encourage you to pray for them regularly. Secondly, to do what I can to give them the good news of Jesus the Messiah, always be ready and willing to answer your own prayer by sharing the gospel with your Jewish acquaintances. If you're a Gentile believer, there are two excellent tools that you can use. The first tool is literature. Not just any literature, but literature that was written for the Jewish mind, explain the gospel in a Jewish way. Part of REL's policy is to provide you with literature free of charge. If you get them out to Jewish hands, you make sure the finance is not a stumbling block. All you have to do is drop us a note, tell us how many Jewish persons you want literature for, we'll send you a packet for each one of them. Now, we learned in our ministry over the years that many Gentile believers with Jewish friends or acquaintances, but they simply are not willing to share the gospel with them because they're afraid of a possible negative reaction, which is very probable, but I believe it's a price we have to be willing to pay. But there are those who are not quite ready to pay it. If you're in that category, here's what I recommend that you do. Get a hold of literature anyway. Then put the tracts in an envelope and mail it to your Jewish contact without giving your own name or address away. In our ministry, we call this approach chicken evangelism. But it's been known to work. I have met Jewish believers who became believers because someone had anonymously sent literature to them. If you won't do it any other way, try chicken evangelism. God has used it. A second effective tool you can use is sharing your own testimony. The main thing in sharing your testimony is this. That as we grow up in the Jewish community, we don't distinguish between Gentiles and Christians. We tend to use those terms synonymously. As I grew up, if you were not born a Jew, that made you a Gentile, biblically valid, but I also led to believe everybody out there was also a Christian. So the average Jewish mind, everybody out there is not Jewish, is a Christian. That includes Hitler, Mussolini, the Pope, Billy Graham, the Dallas Cowboys, all Gentiles, all Christians. I threw in the Dallas Cowboys for two reasons. First of all, I am a Dallas Cowboy fan, and I had a deep godly depression this afternoon. But secondly, among the Jewish people, the game of football is reckoned to be purely a Gentile game. That's why they're all classed as Christians. Because it wouldn't be very Jewish running around this whole field chasing a pigskin. So in your testimony, the thing you have to emphasize clearly is that while you were born a Gentile, you could not be born a Christian. That's not a possibility. To become a Christian takes a decision to be made, to believe what the gospel teaches. Until one has made that decision, he cannot be classed as a biblical Christian. Only when a Jewish person realizes there is this difference between Gentiles and Christians can he begin to seriously consider the claims of the Messiah. Until that happens, it's very difficult for him. But literature and testimony are two tools you can use. A third way of participating with us is to pray for the work of our young ministries. You read the brochure more thoroughly, those specific guidelines in praying. Then fourthly, to make a monthly commitment of so much for the next 2 years. Our young ministry is an independent faith ministry. We now back many large church or group of denominational churches or other organizations of that kind. Most of our support comes from individuals. About 20% comes from local churches. 80% comes from individuals that made a monthly commitment. If anybody here might feel so led, mark the amount by the dollar sign in the middle of the page, fill in name and address, tear the slip off and drop in the offering plate as it comes around in a few moments. If you do make a monthly commitment, the principle is you do nothing about it, you hear from us. Let you know by letter when to begin mailing your commitment in, and that will be the only time you'll hear from us about this. I realize that the ministries send out reminders to people who make commitments but don't follow through. We won't do that because it violates the faith principle by which we operate. So once you get that one letter telling you when to begin, you won't hear from us about this again. We do believe any commitment you make is not between you and us, but between you and the Lord. If God does supply the amount you commit yourself to, mail in, but if not, you won't. It's that simple. This is the way the ministry is both sustained as well as knowing when it could be expanded. On the other hand, we realize God does not lead everyone to make a commitment, and if you're in that category but want to be put on a mailing list, the last box is for that purpose that says, I do not wish to make a commitment at the present time, but please put me on your mailing list. Simply fill this out and turn it in. And what this means is, in about 4 to 6 weeks, we'll send you a package with 3 things in it. First of all, there'll be some more information about the ministry as a whole. Secondly, a catalog of all our books, tapes, and manuscripts so you can pursue other studies along this line. And thirdly, it will contain a 2-cassette tapes of testimonies, one of my own and one of my co-director, Barry Leventhal, as we each explain how we found our Messiah in different categories and contexts. After that, every 3 months, we'll send you a newsletter which looks like this. It is 8 pages. The other 4 pages are news of our branches in the U.S., Canada, Israel, and Europe. But the middle 4 pages is a written-out Bible study. We pick a topic. This one happens to be on the 8 mysteries of the New Testament. And we write it out in a teaching format from a Jewish perspective. This part can be pulled out, read, studied, filed, and used as God gives you the opportunity to use it. And each of our newsletters comes with this Bible study. If you want to receive it, simply fill out the slip. With or without the commitment, it is not a prerequisite. We'll be happy to start sending it to you. Now, in a moment, we'll be taking up a free will offering for our young ministries. If you wish to receive a receipt for the amount you're giving tonight, mark the amount at the far left, or it says I'm closing so much in today's offering. We will send you a number of receipt for income tax records. If you write out a check, the check may be made out to our young ministries. Also, want to make another point clear is that if you happen to be in Ariel's ministry's mailing list, one thing you will never ever get is any appeals for money. There are no appeals for funds in the newsletter, no separate appeal letters are ever sent out. You will never get a letter from us saying, unless you send us all your money, I will die in 4 months. That too would violate our faith principle, and would, we don't operate that way. So you receive announcements, newsletters, and Bible studies. You will not receive at any point of time any appeals for funds. Now, at this point, we'll have the ushers come forward and take the offering. As the offering is being taken, let me make another announcement. After the offering, we'll have a break, and I believe there is refreshments out in the courtyard. Am I right? Yes, out in the courtyard. Now, as you go out in the foyer, there is a display table, and on that table is a sign-up sheet. If you want to receive the tapes of the night studies, all you have to do is give them an address on that sheet and check off the box for tapes. Also on that table is just one book, one copy of each book available from Ariel Ministries. These are display copies only on a variety of topics. The one book most relevant to our study tonight is called The Footsteps of the Messiah. It incorporates all the prophecies of the Bible put in chronological sequence. If you want to order, they need the books, the boxes to check off on the same sheet. And what's going to happen is that the office will bill you for the material later. And the minute the material at that time, you don't pay for what you ordered tonight. All you need for now is your name and address. If you want the tapes, check off the appropriate box for tapes. If you want any of the books, just check off the book by the title. And that is all that's necessary for tonight. All right, will the ushers come forward then?